that you made me feel like a clown. There are a whole lot of girls, looking for a good man like you. Oh, but you'll never meet them if you give up now and say your life is true. Then she said, oh, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Hey, you gotta be a man. You gotta take a stand.
This Friday is the day after St. Patrick's Day, but the celebration continues. I'm moving on right after the noon news to 1:30. Host Don Jacobson will be presenting an entire program of performances by Irish musicians and music about Ireland. We'll hear Kevin Burke and the Bothy Band, Karen Casey, Planxty, and selections from a newly remastered classic album, Andy Irvine and Paul Brady. Tune in this Friday, just after noon, to 1:30, only on KBOO.
Over the last several years, some local governments have named their cities and counties gun sanctuaries, where police refuse to enforce any new gun laws. And some residents, like this community college professor, have pushed back. There was a shooting at her school in 2013, not far from Virginia Tech, where 32 students and professors were gunned down 6 years earlier. She's appalled at the thought of creating a gun sanctuary in a county where there have been not one, but two college shootings.
And like others who have come before me, I ask the board to consider what a Second Amendment sanctuary designation will symbolize to those who continue to suffer the lasting trauma of gun violence in a county that has suffered two school shootings. I can only speak for myself and say that calling a county a Second Amendment sanctuary is a perversion of the word sanctuary. My classroom should have been a sanctuary.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today, a school shooting drives a teacher to activism. Later in the show, when police encounter the mentally ill.
The other officer who my colleague was riding with came in on the radio to my officer and said, look, I have to tell you, we've been out to this guy three times in the past 24 hours. He is a really big guy and he looks like he will probably rip your head off. And I want you to know that he is not going to do that.
But first, after Columbine, Virginia Tech, and Sandy Hook, among many others, you'd expect to find a trove of literature from the perspective of teachers who endured those school slaughters. But you'd be wrong. Megan Doney is an English professor at New River Community College in Dublin, Virginia. After a student opened fire there in 2013, she took to writing her own reflections to help her and other professors and teachers cope. A note to listeners, this interview discusses gun violence in some detail. Megan, tell me about the day a student shot two women while you were teaching at New River Community College.
This occurred on the afternoon of Friday, April 12th, 2013. And on that afternoon, at about 2 o'clock, I was in class with my students when we heard the first gunshot. And I initially thought that it was a car backfiring, And then we heard two more shots. I knew what it was. And my classroom was just adjacent to an emergency exit. I threw the door open and turned to my students and said, "Get out." And they leaped over their desks and streamed through this emergency exit into the parking lot at the New River Valley Mall. Those who had been had enough forethought had grabbed their keys and they jumped into their cars and peeled away. And others of us who were out there with nothing but ourselves hid behind parked cars. There were some of us who were welcomed into strangers' cars in the parking lot. So for a while, my sense of time falls apart a little bit. It seemed like it took forever, but I'm sure that in the scheme of it, it happened rather quickly. But I stood outside for a while, continuing to hear the gunfire from inside, but no one else was coming out. And in the moment, I wasn't afraid. I don't remember having any real fear at all. The fear came later. For a while, it was more just a shock and kind of a numbness.
So you went back to school Wednesday after the shooting. Did you talk about it with your students?
I did. I created a document that I titled Post-Shooting Lesson Plans. Nothing had prepared me to craft that document.
What did you learn about your shooter? This was an 18-year-old student, a guy, who attended a branch of the community college. You wrote about the reaction to the shock people felt over discovering who this 18-year-old boy was and how he might have done this. I mean, how he could possibly have done this.
Yeah. A lot of people in communities where this happens fall back on a statement like, "This isn't who we are," because the event itself is so alien and such a profound violation of what they believe to be true about themselves and about the community. But when, you know, the people who commit these acts are members of our communities, it is who we are. I don't know that we can distance ourselves. I'm not sure that that helps us to tackle the real problems of disaffected people with access to weapons and an intent to harm. I think that there's a real misperception that people who commit rampage acts of violence just snap, and the evidence just doesn't bear that out. Many of them, you know, think about this for a long time, make elaborate plans, leave behind letters or diagrams or videos and so forth.
So much has been written about the students' experience of these violent attacks at schools, but you found very little about what teachers go through.
I did, and this was a particularly devastating aspect of the aftermath of the shooting. I went to the library to try to find research or memoirs or, you know, studies about what happened to educators who had witnessed or survived an act of violence at school. And again, this was 2013. This was after Columbine, after Virginia Tech, after Sandy Hook. I remember typing in, you know, as many permutations of search terms as I could think of and came up with nothing, really. And so I guess I decided that I was going to have to write those things, not just for myself, but for, you know, the educators who came after me, because I knew that they were going to feel the same kind of loss and dislocation and confusion and violation. And I just thought, well, I have to create what I needed when it didn't exist.
You took some time off teaching after this. Why?
I went on a sabbatical at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa. There's a wonderful quotation from the book The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder by the Army veteran and journalist David J. Morris, who writes that the urge to travel or to lose oneself in a distant place is written across the lives of so many survivors. I had wanted to go there because it was home to the Institute for Trauma, Reconciliation, and Forgiveness Studies, and it was headed by a woman who had served on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I was very interested in learning how the act of public witnessing and storytelling might be applied in an American context to survivors of gun violence or mass violence.
And that year and subsequently, you have devoted your life to gun violence prevention.
Yes. I spoke in Pittsburgh in October after the release of an anthology called If I Don't Make It, I Love You. And I and one of the victims of the New River, the shooting at New River, are profiled in this book. And someone asked me, you know, what I want ultimately. And really all I want is for nobody else to have to live with this. I can't make it any clearer than that. I don't want any other educator to have to write post-shooting lesson plans.
What have you learned in your research about gun violence?
Well, I've learned that a lot of the cliches and the tropes that you hear in the public arena are just not borne out by evidence. In the United States, most people who keep a gun in the home cite protection as their primary reason for having one. But there's considerable evidence that shows that the presence of a gun in the home elevates the risk of harm to everyone. Certainly the masculinity aspect is another one that I have spent quite a lot of time diving into.
You've actually written an essay about how all of these school shooters have been men, none of them women.
Yes. This is a fact that continues to confound me. The fact that the vast majority of these tragedies are perpetrated by men and boys is almost completely ignored in the media. I feel confident that if women and girls were doing this, you would hear an awful lot about what's wrong with women and girls and why they are committing these kinds of acts. The masculine aspect is really overlooked. We might talk about people or perpetrators when really we're talking about men and boys.
A lot of people say, well, maybe it is influenced by violent video games that these young men are playing, or that they're taking Prozac for some other ailment.
There's no evidence of that. And women and girls also play violent video games. They also take medications. They also experience bullying. They also experience romantic rejection. They also experience trauma or disruption in the home. They have the same access to firearms, and they don't commit these acts.
You've been going to gun shows. What's that like?
It's been very eye-opening. I really felt that if I was going to speak with any authority on the subject, I needed to go to a gun show to see what actually happened. And at one of the gun shows, you know, I stopped by a table and there were AR-15s for sale. And these were for sale by a private seller. So that means that I could have simply paid cash for it and walked out with that gun. I would not have had to go through a background check again because it's a private sale. I really wonder what it means to be a responsible gun owner, because if I had done that, that would have been perfectly legal. But there is no universe in which I am the person to handle that. I don't understand why that is okay. So at another gun show, a vendor told me that because I was a small woman, I needed to be carrying all the time. Otherwise, I really put my husband in a very difficult position, having to protect me all the time. The implication is clear that if something happens to me,
It is my own fault because I chose not to carry a gun to protect myself. It's not the fault of the person who attempts to mug me or rape me. I wish that people were more aware of that kind of implicit victim blaming that goes on.
Ironically, the experience of the shooter at your school in 2013, this happened not far from Virginia Tech, where a student gunned down 32 students and faculty members in 2007.
Yes.
And yet, your county, Montgomery County, where both of these horrible shootings took place, is one of dozens of counties in Virginia where gun owners are now flocking to local government meetings, demanding they become gun sanctuaries to at least symbolically block passage of a lot of gun measures.
Yes. In the last few months, I've attended a couple of Board of Supervisors meetings in Montgomery County about that issue. In one of the statements that I made, I said that I thought it was a dubious distinction that Montgomery County had been home to two school shootings, and that designating it as a Second Amendment sanctuary was gravely insensitive and insulting to the number of people who have struggled and continue to suffer from the effects of gun violence in that county.
What was the crowd like at the meetings you attended in Montgomery about this issue? Was it sort of evenly divided on the gun issue?
The first meeting was extremely heavily weighted towards the pro-gun side. The second meeting in December had a greater turnout for people arguing against that measure. But still, the number of pro-gun rights supporters was greater at both meetings. I try to remind myself that they believe in their position as deeply as I believe in mine.
You have told me that these days you're struggling with empathy. What do you mean by that? Who are you trying to empathize with?
Well, I do struggle to empathize, I think, with some of the more heated and sometimes violent rhetoric that comes out of the pro-gun rights side. It's important to me to make sure that I don't dehumanize the other side. Spending a year in South Africa and studying, you know, reconciliation and the history of apartheid really made me think quite a lot about how dangerous it is to dehumanize other people, even the ones with whom we deeply disagree. And I just find myself continuing to struggle with that and to try to understand where others are coming from and why.
Why do you think your pain over this has lasted so long for you?
I really think that teaching and learning are holy. And when we enter a classroom with students of any age, we're asking them to rethink what they believe to be true. And so a classroom is really, I think, a crucible of change and vulnerability. And so when an act of violence strikes at that place, it is a spiritual and moral crisis.
Megan Doney is a writer and English professor at New River Community College. When someone calls 911, police are usually the first on the scene. But what if it's a mental health crisis? Charlotte Gill is an associate professor of criminology at George Mason University. She's working to build understanding and positive relationships between communities and police. Charlotte, you have worked with police departments trying to reduce the amount of time police spend on calls with people who have mental illnesses. Why does that matter? Do police spend a lot of time with people who have mental health crises?
They do, typically. There's maybe about 7 to 10% of all calls for service tend to have some kind of mental health issue. But the real big deal here is that a lot of these cases result in a higher risk of use of force. And the police just spend more time on these calls. They spend more of their resources. We found in one department that calls involving someone having a mental health crisis typically took about 25% longer than other types of calls.
Do you think police officers are frustrated with how often they end up being first responder in what is really a medical or a mental health medical issue?
I think they are. I think most police officers, obviously, they're compassionate people. They want to be able to help and do the best that they can. But this is just really not the kind of thing that they're trained for. They're not necessarily equipped to deal with somebody who maybe they're putting themselves or other people in danger through their behavior. It's an incredibly stressful and difficult process for the police to have to deal with.
What sorts of training do you think police officers routinely get when it comes to mental health issues?
So the most common kind of training that's happening in many departments now is called crisis intervention team training, or CIT, training police in de-escalation tactics, making them aware of different types of mental and behavioral health issues, how some of those symptoms present, what kind of medications people might be taking, and so on. But one of the frustrations that I've heard from police officers with this training is it doesn't necessarily equip them to know what to do when they're confronting one of these situations. It's one thing to know, what is autism, what is schizophrenia, what kind of medications are people on. That's all useful information. But when I'm in a situation where somebody's in crisis and I have to handle it, it doesn't necessarily matter to me what those distinctions are. I just need to know what to do. A lot of police training is very tactical focused. And I think there's a case to be made for practicing those kind of people skills as well, to actually spend time in dialogue and being exposed to people who have mental health issues or their family members, and actually just being able to sit down and talk to them and understand what are some of the kind of things that trigger this kind of behavior. What are some of the things that we might need to know to help calm you down? For example, some people with autism don't like to be touched. They process touch and pain very differently. So even a police officer coming in and, putting their arm around somebody to try to comfort them, or just putting a hand on their arm to try to move them out of the way, that could be incredibly triggering. So that if they realize something's not working, they can say, oh, is this just because this person's being a jerk and not listening to me? Or perhaps it's because they don't know how to process this command that I'm giving them.
Community policing is a concept that's been with us for quite some time. Is it enjoying a resurgence now, would you say?
Pretty much every single police department in the U.S. says that it's doing community policing in some way, shape, or form. I went to a training a few years ago just to observe the day of the training academy where they covered community policing. And I thought that was really interesting because community policing at its heart is meant to be a philosophy. It's not a tactic. It's not a strategy necessarily. It's meant to be a holistic approach to policing that the departments adopt. And so I thought it was really interesting that within this 20-week academy, they had the community policing day. And it struck me, and I obviously didn't go to the whole academy, so I can't say for certain how much it was reinforced throughout the other 20 weeks. But it certainly didn't seem like this was something that was kind of a thread that was running through the whole academy experience.
You had a very telling experience when you were riding along with a police officer responding to a report that a man was off his meds and behaving violently in a group home.
Yes, that was working with one of the police departments that I've collaborated with. So this man, as you said, had been off his meds. He had become violent and he had punched a hole through the wall of his bedroom in the group home. And as we were driving there, we had the flashing lights going, we were driving fast, and the other officer who my colleague was riding with came in on the radio to my officer and said, look, I have to tell you, we've been out to this guy 3 times in the past 24 hours. He has some kind of developmental disorder and he's obviously having some kind of issue with this medication right now. So I just want you to know when you get there, he is a really big guy. He looks really scary. He's like 6'4". He's really big around. And he looks like he will probably rip your head off. And I want you to know that he is not going to do that. He is actually, a real softie. And he said one of the things that really helped calm him down the last couple of times was police badge stickers. So, these police stickers that they give out to kids. And he said, do you have any with you? Because I've given him all of the ones that I had. in the last few times that I've been out to him. And so my officer says, of course, yeah, I'll make sure to bring some in. So when we went into the house, the guy had actually kind of calmed down on his own by this point, but he was sitting on the sofa, he was crying. He wasn't particularly verbal, but the officers just kind of got down on their knees so that they were at his eye level. They sat with him, they comforted him, and they just asked him if he was okay, what was going on. And it was just such a warm interaction. And I just wondered to myself, what would this have looked like if the other officer who was riding with my colleague hadn't been on duty at that time? That could have gone very, very differently. So that kind of information sharing and just knowledge and compassion and, you know, nuance, really. I think it's just the nuance of understanding that somebody who's being violent, somebody who's engaged in an act that we would generally think of as being, you know, this is bad behavior, there may be many, many layers going on beneath the surface.
Tell me about the notion of fear in policing. Fear, when police officers are responding, as they so often do, to the unknown. In this case, there could have been fear on the part of an officer thinking, oh no, here's this man acting violently, punching holes in walls. What's going to happen when I get there?
Absolutely. Police are human too. You know, they want to get home to their family at the end of the day. They're concerned about their own safety, obviously. So I think it's absolutely natural to assume that police are going to be fearful. I think one of the challenges is that there's a lot of emphasis on this idea of getting home safely, which absolutely there should be. But sometimes I think that can kind of creep into creating sort of an us and them mentality between police and the community, so that police are perhaps thinking that everybody they come across is going to hurt them in some way. To some extent, the police are only dealing with people at their worst. For the very most part, nobody calls the police because they're having a great day. The fact that the police are dealing with people when, you know, they've committed a crime or something terrible has happened, something tragic has happened, they've been victimized, they're in crisis, they're seeing people at their worst. And so I think that having more of an understanding, more opportunity to actually interact and have dialogue with the community, and to understand things more from that perspective is really important.
Going back to the original study that you did with a couple of police departments, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast of the United States, do you think reducing police interaction with people who have mental illness would also reduce fatalities and injury to both sides?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's not necessarily just a question of reducing, because I think realistically the police are always, unless we have a fundamental change in the way that we do things in society in general, the police are almost always going to still be the first responders to situations where people are in crisis. In the project that we've been doing with the Shoreline Washington Police Department, we looked at essentially pairing officers with a mental health practitioner. They would go out and do follow-up and outreach rather than actually being there at the time that somebody called 911. She was able, just from her own knowledge and very different training from what the police have, to be able to direct them to services or treatment that they might need. And that's obviously something that the police are not trained to do, and I don't think it's realistic to expect them to do. So I do think that initiatives like that, where police are still doing police work, right? They're still responding to emergencies, they're still responding to 911 calls, but then they can call in somebody who actually has that expertise, has a massive potential to reduce injuries, use of force. You know, it allows the person to get the help that they need and reduces the likelihood that they're going to call again.
But of course, that takes us to the depressing area where we all are, which is there's just not enough money either in policing, police training, or in medical facilities for people dealing with mental health crises, right?
Absolutely. That's a huge issue. And not only do you need somebody who's an amazing mental health professional, you also need somebody who knows how to navigate that police culture, who can take care of themselves in a potentially dangerous situation, who's not going to be an additional burden to the police officer. I think just one last thing to say about just the challenge of policing. It's really, really difficult to have to make a split-second decision that could be the split second that determines whether you or somebody else lives, dies, becomes injured. You know, yes, in a democratic society, the police have the ability to use force where other citizens don't. Maybe they should be held to a higher standard in some regard, but they're also human beings. And so there's a lot more nuance here than I think a lot of people realize.
Charlotte Gill is the deputy director of the Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy at George Mason University. She was named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. We invite you to take part in the Virginia Festival of the Book, with events for readers of all ages and interests taking place in person in Charlottesville, Virginia, as well as online, March 16th through 20th. Go to vabook.org. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. Longwood University in Farmville, Virginia, is not a research institution, but that didn't stop two intrepid professors from workshopping a synthetic biology project and involving their students in the creation.
Right. I remember asking you, so I know you're a chemist, but what exactly do you study? I think you said, oh, I study gunshot residue detection, but you probably can't make bacteria do that. And I said, yeah, we can. Let's look it up.
Sarah Porter is an associate professor of analytical chemistry at Longwood. She and Amaret Barber, an associate professor of biology there, brought their two fields together to test out the use of bacteria to detect gunshot residue, and it worked. Amaret, you and Sarah invented a new way to detect gunshot residue for forensic scientists out of bacteria, E. coli, no less. And all of this came from a workshop you and Sarah attended where you were to practice making tools out of synthetic biology. What is synthetic biology?
It's kind of like genetic engineering. And so basically, we take different pieces of DNA, and then you could just kind of, it's like cut and paste. You just basically glue them together the way you want, and then you can make new types of little machines.